We hear now the story of two men, Jim Thorpe and Pop Warner. Before these men became legends, they met in 1907 at the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania, where they forged one of the winningest teams in American football history. Called the team that invented football, they took on the best opponents of their day, defeating much more privileged schools such as Harvard and the Army in a series of breathtakingly close calls, genius plays, and bone-crushing hard work. Author Steve Scheinkin's new book is Undefeated, Jim Thorpe and the Carlisle Indian School Football Team, the story of a group of young men who came together at that school, the overwhelming obstacles they faced both on and off the field, and their absolute refusal to accept defeat. There will be a launch party for the book. The book officially comes out on Tuesday. Well, there'll be a launch party for the book on Sunday at the North Shire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs, New York at 5 o'clock. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Steve Scheinkin to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. What led you to Jim Thorpe and Pop Warner?
I always wanted to do a sports story. I had it in my mind for years and just was looking for something that was bigger than the games themselves. I love narrative nonfiction that centers around underdog sports stories like Seabiscuit or The Boys in the Boat.
Right.
And it turns out you don't have to care about those sports at all, which I actually don't, but got so caught up in them. I'd want to do something like that. And when I came across this story of Jim Thorpe, who's quite famous in a general way as being, maybe the greatest American athlete to ever live, but I didn't know anything about his time at the Carlisle Indian School and their football team, and that they really kind of invented football as we know it as a sport and made it much more popular than it had been and had this run that is just straight out of a Hollywood underdog sports story. That's what attracted me to it, and then I realized there was much more to it than the sports.
Growing up in Pennsylvania, I heard about Jim Thorpe all the time.
Of course.
But I assume unless you know the sport sort of outside of the state's borders, you perhaps maybe don't know the name.
I think that's true, especially of the younger generation than we are. I think he's not well known, and I introduce him by saying that he is like the LeBron James, the Michael Jordan, the Bo Jackson, whatever icon you can think of as that greatest all-around athlete who can really do anything. And I want kids, again, to know that Jim Thorpe sort of invented that in American sports.
So you have Jim Thorpe, this incredible athlete, an Olympic gold medalist, and Native American. You also have Pop Warner, who is the coach and just a mastermind of the game. Nobody knows the game better than Pop Warner, and with an Ivy League background. So you put these two together, and it's a pretty interesting mix.
It makes an interesting mix from a lot of standpoints. The coach-player dynamic, they clash. They were just a classic personality clash, which only adds to the drama of this story. But Jim was a quiet, very, very determined guy who just could not be bossed. He could not be told what to do. And Warner was loud, foul-mouthed, cursing at his players, just physically getting on the field with them, shoving them around. So they were destined to not get along, basically. Although, as is often the case, when they had the chemistry together on the field, as long as they were playing and winning, it worked.
How did the two first come to be with each other?
They met, as you said, at Carlisle. Pop got there first. He, as you say, he went to Cornell, just basically because he couldn't figure out what else to do, and his dad wanted him to be a lawyer, which he thought sounded awful.
Mm-hmm.
But he saw some guys playing this sport of American football, and he was big. He was about 6'2". And they said, hey, we need a guard. Come on the field. And he said, I've never seen the game before. But they said, no, don't worry, you're big. So he learned the game. He realized he wasn't an athlete. He had the size, but not the talent. So he started dabbling in strategy, which was basically an unheard of thing in football. He ended up coaching for a while at Cornell. And then when they played Carlisle played all their games on the road. No important or big schools would come to Pennsylvania to play Carlisle, which was just another thing that they were up against. And he saw Carlisle when they came to Cornell and was very impressed by their athleticism and their heart. He realized they didn't have a full-time coach. He said, boy, these guys could really use a coach. And he went there seeing an opportunity and had begun to work with them and begun to really create some groundbreaking teams, introducing things like strategy and tempo to the game, when Jim showed up at the school, who was a skinny kid. Jim tried out for track because it was something he could do. He was very fast. And I start the book with this scene where Jim walks onto the football field to try out for the team in 1907. And Pop Warner tells him to get out of here. He says, "You're way too skinny. You'll get killed playing football," which was not a joke in those days. There were years when 15 to 20 students would die a year playing football. And Pop just didn't think Jim could take it.
Carlisle has an interesting story in and of itself of being in an Indian boarding school, and really one of the first federally funded off reservation schools, right?
Yes, that's sort of a third strand to the story. You have Jim and Pop, and then the school itself is part of the story. And it was founded in the late 1800s as a boarding school where students, it was put in Pennsylvania for deliberate reason, which was to take kids mostly from the Midwest at that time, as far away from their families and traditions as possible, to really break those ties and to re-educate them as white Americans. And they thought of them as, Richard Henry Pratt, who founded this school, thought of them as immigrants. So I'm going to assimilate them into white American culture. And in his mind, that was their best chance for a future in this country. So that's the setting for the story. And it's also part of the reason I think it's a story about much more than sports, because it's also a story about Native American history.
It is a story of Native American history, and also the fact that there are so many tribes represented within the school. I think total was, 140 or something like that,
yes,
of different tribes that had attended the school.
Yes, they came from all over the country, some against their will, some specifically, especially later years, to play football. It's a very modern story. There's another element of it. The college football hasn't changed at all. This wasn't the college, but the guys were in their teens, up to their teens and early 20s, so they played in the world of college football. And nothing has changed. I mean, Pop Warner found out ways to sneak payments to these guys. He recruited from reservations all over the country. He had at a department store in Carlisle an account set up where the players could go and charge suits and hats and ties. And it was all just a way of funneling money to elite athletes so that they would come and then stay at the school to play football.
Corporal punishment was part of the...
At Carlisle, it was very much so. Pratt infamously had a whip in his office. He denied it, but there's really strong evidence that he did. They had an old guardhouse that was built by George Washington during the Revolution to house German prisoners of war. And they used it. It was terrifying. They used it for students. If students ran away, if they broke any of the dozens of rules. Jim Thorpe spent time there because he hated school. And it wasn't just because of the racism at Carlisle. It was he just hated school. He had never been a good or interested student and couldn't sit still, and wound up mostly for running away, which was a very major offense, that spending some time in that guardhouse as well.
I want to get to, obviously, the story of these two men and the central story you tell. But it was a school, and it was a place where they were working really hard to kind of strip the kids of their identity too, to allow them to quote unquote fit in by taking away their Native American identity.
That was Pratt's philosophy. He very famously said that his goal was to kill the Indian in them and save the man. And in his warped mind, this was helping them. This was giving them a chance in a rapidly changing world. And there are some very stark scenes that I include in the early days when the first batch of students showed up by train. Right away, they were stripped of their clothing. The boys had their long hair cut. And they sat in a classroom, and a teacher they described it as being on another planet. You know, and I think for them it was like they'd been transported to another world. This teacher, speaking a language that they, of course, did not know, English, started giving them names. She put a bunch of names on the blackboard, names from the Bible, names from American history, and had them pick names as if they didn't already have names that were very important to them. And those became their names. She would write them on a piece of paper and pin them to the students so that they could remember and practice their names. I think that's just a very stark example of what that school was all about.
So how did all of this go over for Jim Thorpe?
Jim, he hated all of it. Like I said, he had been to Indian schools right from the start. His dad, both of his parents were of mixed race, but Native American and European backgrounds. But they wanted him to be educated in English. They would send him to the school at his reservation in Oklahoma. And he just hated it from day one. And partly because of, again, the racist treatment of the kids, but also just he just hated sitting still in class. And so it became a running problem with him. He would run away from schools. He was sent to a school 200 miles from home eventually because his father got so sick of it. But he ran away and walked home from there at age 13. Mm. And that's how he wound up at Carlisle, because his father was so sick of it. He said, I'm going to send you so far away that you can't come back home. And he sent him all the way to Pennsylvania as a teenager. And Jim never did well in school. He wasn't a terrible student. He skated by. I mean, I think that he got by because he was a great athlete, and so they wanted to keep him around.
So at the point where he comes to the school, what do you think ultimately clicked with him to say, okay, I have a place here and something that I can do and I can do well?
Yeah, he talked about that. He talked about just being amongst, even though, like you say, it was a very diverse student body. There were some kids who were from his area in Oklahoma, but many different nations from all over the country. But he just felt at home there in a way that he never had before. And it was partly the camaraderie. One of the things that Pop did, the really corrupt but typical things that he did when running a sports program, is he had a special dorm for the students who were elite athletes. They got better food. They had better amenities. They had newspapers delivered and much more comfortable digs to live in. And so he was surrounded by friends. He was hardly ever at school. Once the football team really took off, they traveled. Like I said, no one would come to them. So they had to play all their games on the road for weeks and weeks at a time, and they would stay in hotels. For them, it was actually quite nice because they were away from the ruthless rules and oppression of the school. But they were also on the road together, taking trains together, going to restaurants, playing in front of packed crowds everywhere they went. When they would go to, say, Boston to play Harvard, it was the event of the year. Mm. That's something I didn't realize. This was the most famous football team in the country in Jim's years. In 1911, they drew a bigger crowd at Harvard than the World Series did that year.
And how much was that because of him?
It was a big part. He was a big part of it. I also emphasize in the book, though, that there were many other great athletes at Carlisle and tell their stories as well. And the team was on the rise and famous even before Jim joined them. But in those glory years, 1911, 1912, when they really were traveling the country and becoming the biggest story in sports, that was largely because of Jim.
The name of the book is Undefeated, Jim Thorpe and the Carlisle Indian School Football Team. At what point did Pop Warner realize what he had?
Pretty quickly, I think. Again, he had other great players, but he saw something very special in Jim right away when Jim joined the team about age 19. And they started to clash immediately. He started to try to coach Thorpe, and Thorpe would say things like, why do I have to run over them? You know, I'll just do it the way I want. You know, I'll just run around them. I don't need to take your strategies. But they worked together well, I think, as long as they were continuing to play and continuing to win. And it even got to the point where Pop designed a new offense, a new scheme, a formation that became basically the standard formation of college football for a century almost because of Jim. Because he said, I got to put this guy, he's a playmaker. I've got to create a formation where I can get him the ball in more creative and opportune ways.
So talk about that, of what he was within the course of the game, what he was so good at.
Yeah, he did everything. In those days, not only did they not wear padding, but they played every play on offense, defense, kicking plays, everything. So on offense, Jim was essentially a running back. He would stand next to the quarterback, and on defense, he would be a linebacker, essentially. But what he was really great at was his running the ball, and so Pop wanted to figure out any way possible to get the ball in his hands. And so this new formation, which he called the single wing, it's been used recently. Football fans will recognize it as the Wildcat, which was considered new when teams started running it a few years ago. But this was the Jim Thorpe, Pop Warner offense, where the ball could be snapped directly to the back, the running back, Jim, in this case, and just different ways to get him the ball. He could run with it. He could look downfield, and if they were covering the run, he could throw it. He could do anything. And he really, on the field, was not just the strongest, but also the fastest player.
When it came to game time, and you're right about this, but I'm just curious as to when the word started to get out that this was something to see.
Yeah, that happened. Like I said, they
it gelled pretty quick.
It gelled quickly, and papers covered their. This was one of the beautiful, from a researching standpoint, things about covering or researching this book was that, of course, even Syracuse had four daily papers in 1911, right. and they all wrote four or five. They didn't just write the game day article. They wrote on Wednesday, Carlisle, the Indians have come. They're staying in this hotel. We're going to go and try to talk to them. And then there'd be they're practicing today, but it's secret. They would hire guards to patrol their practice field so people couldn't steal their plays. I mean, it was a really big thing. And then, of course, articles about the game and charts and box scores. And so I could tell just by looking at the papers what a big deal it became once they really hit their stride.
When you look at the games and the accomplishments of the team, as you say, I mean, we focus on these two men, but the whole team was amazing. The ending record, how many games were played and the ending record being?
They played, I really focus on the years that Jim was there. There was something like 55-4 in those years.
Yeah.
And the name Undefeated of the book has kind of a double meaning. It certainly has a deeper meaning than just records. But they were always going for that undefeated season. That was a big deal even then, to win the national championship. And in 1911 and 1912, it comes right down to the wire as they're playing a much harder schedule than anybody else, all on the road. And there are some key games in both of the years, 1911 at Harvard and 1912. You just couldn't make this up. But there's one place that was even more significant to them than Harvard to go, and that was West Point. And if you can imagine a game dripping with symbolism, kids who grew up on reservations playing kids whose parents had put them on those reservations. And they knew. In fact, the government didn't allow these teams to play because they thought it would just be too fraught. And in 1912, they have their climactic game at West Point. You just couldn't make something like that up. Dwight Eisenhower was on that team. And so that really becomes, from a storytelling standpoint, a wonderful thing to build toward.
Everything comes together.
It does, yes.
And then Jim Thorpe goes on to the Olympics.
Yeah, he played in the Olympics between those 2 years. He the summer in Stockholm of 1912, and won two gold medals in all-around sports, the decathlon and pentathlon. He was literally the best athlete in the world and recognized as such, and then came back for what would essentially be a senior year of college.
Mm-hmm. And then they named a town after him.
That's weird, though. Did you grow up thinking that it was weird that his body was there?
Yeah.
Because it's creepy, because he never had anything, as far as I could tell, to do with the town. Isn't that right?
I mean, there was some geographical closeness to Carlisle,
right,
but other than that, no.
And it's controversial to this day, because I think there are family members who would prefer the body to be back in Oklahoma, where he's from. But I guess a deal was made that we'll name the town. You give us the...
You give us the corpse, we'll give you the town.
Yeah.
We'll give you a zip code.
Yep.
Very strange.
Very strange, indeed.
What do you think, and I can ask this question, not just about this book, but all of your work, which is, what do you try to accomplish, and what do you hope that the reader, and we should note, usually a younger reader, will mm-hmm. take away about these very special people and very special experiences in our history?
Well, everything I do every day is rooted in my work as a textbook writer. I did that for many years, wrote history textbooks, and I'm still trying to make amends for that by doing what I do now, which is to write nonfiction for the same age, young, they call it middle grade, young adult. I'm talking about middle school primarily, sometimes younger, a little older too. But I really want to reach that age, which is not easy, with exciting, page-turning nonfiction. I think it's really important to know history, but if you go in and tell students, hey, I'm going to teach you something important, you're lost. So instead I say, I'm going to tell you a story. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do. I think the sports book angle for me, the 12-year-old me would have worked. I would have picked it up because of that. And then I would have realized, or maybe not even realized, hey, I just learned a lot of American history too.
We were talking just before we came on about how it's a beautiful book. You include a lot of photographs that are in the archive. And as you say, there's really a lot out there, isn't there?
The photos are great. The stark black and white photos, they were a big story. So they appeared in newspapers every day. And there's a wealth of really beautiful sports photography and just portraits of the players themselves.
There's a great picture of Dwight Eisenhower as a cadet.
Eisenhower, yes.
Just like so young, and yet you can still see Ike in there.
Absolutely, yes. And I do tell his story toward the end in parallel in that 1912 season, because he was not really a great athlete, but kind of worked his way onto the team. And to him, too, it was a very big deal to play against Jim Thorpe.
Mm. And the other thing you talk about, and we think about this today, and I mean, I don't want to extrapolate too much into, you know, our conversations about sports at the current day, but this was a really brutal game and a brutal business, wasn't it?
Very much so. In modern ways, we talked about the business and the corruption of basically paying players. But just physically, it was a brutal game. And this was also a surprise to me, more dangerous than today's game. The players were smaller, but they did not wear protection. And there were these mass plays. Guys would just kind of mass together and run into each other. And it got to the point in 1905 where 19 students died that year playing football. And schools started banning the game. Many big-time colleges banned football, and it looked like the whole sport would be entirely banned,
right,
and arguably should have been. One of the main reasons, two main reasons that it weren't, were President Theodore Roosevelt loved football. He hadn't played at Harvard, but he wanted. He couldn't. He was too nearsighted, apparently, to make the team. But of course, he really wanted to play, and he loved the roughness. He said, "This we don't fight wars anymore, so we need football to prepare the elite young men to be leaders in the way wars had done in previous generations." And then the other thing that saved football was the Carlisle Indian team. The fact that they invented a new way to play, they allowed forward passing to stop students from dying in these mass plays. It was kind of regretfully done because Harvard, Yale, who owned the sports, said, we're winning this way. We don't want to change the game. And we have the biggest, we can recruit anyone we want. We get the biggest, strongest players. But when they introduced these new rules, especially allowing passing, Carlisle jumped on that and said, we have a tiny student body. They would go to games with 12, 14 kids, you know. Harvard had 60. So they took advantage of these new rules and saw opportunity in them before anyone else did, and that literally saved the game.
Well, there will be a book launch party for the new book on Sunday at Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs. It's at 5 o'clock.
Yes.
You can find out more information by going to northshire.com. We'll have a link on our website as well at wamc.org, where we'll have this interview posted. But the new book is terrific, and it just looks great. It is Undefeated, Jim Thorpe and the Carlisle Indian School Football Team. Steve Scheinkin, a great pleasure to have you on as always. Thank you very much
for
being with us.
Thank you, Joe. This is my favorite book show to do.
Well, thank you very much. Very nice to have you. Very nice to have you on the program. Again, Steve Scheinkin's new book is Undefeated, Jim Thorpe and the Carlisle Indian School Football Team. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.